This conference will now be recorded.
This is David Terry, Executive Director of NASIO. I appreciate you all for joining us on our Clean Power Plan call this afternoon with our colleagues at the Environmental Protection Agency. A few things we wanted to cover before starting the call briefly. One, we are recording the call today. We do that simply because there are usually great questions and good information, and we like to make that available to NASIO members who either couldn't make the call or want to re-review what they heard or learned on the call, and certainly true for our colleagues at EPA as well and NASIO staff. I also wanted just to point out a few things that I know many of you already know, which is obviously the Clean Power Plan final rule is out. That being said, NASIO has still not taken a position on the rule. We have, though, affirmatively worked throughout the process in a very collaborative fashion with our colleagues at the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners, the National Association of Clean Air Agencies, as well as many other groups, including NGA and trade associations and so forth. And I would like to say in particular with the Environmental Protection Agency, Administrator McCarthy, Acting Administrator Janet McCabe, and all of the EPA staff have been extraordinarily helpful in being responsive to questions and making themselves available, and today's call is another example of that. We have certainly had a number of calls on the topic previously. I wanted just to touch on a few other quick things unrelated to the call. One is, it's obviously a complicated area, but an important area for states. We are focused on issues such as reliability, affordability, and least cost compliance approaches to the Clean Power Plan. Rodney Sobin, on NASIO staff, who's on today's call with us, is leading that activity for NASIO, as well as another number of other air and energy issues. And I would urge the state energy offices and or other colleagues on the call to please feel free to reach out with questions to Rod and or myself for that matter. But Rod really has a great background in this and would encourage you to step up with your questions, whether it's today or by email or call at another date. Other thing I wanted just to mention is we have the NASIO annual meeting coming up. Obviously, we'll cover this topic in depth in a number of ways, both in a general session as well as a breakout session, as well as a workshop on the last day of the conference, which I think should be useful, all geared toward state energy offices, but state least cost compliance, generally speaking. So that's probably, I think, enough. We want to save time to move on to our colleagues at EPA and your questions today. I'd first like to introduce our primary presenter from EPA, Janet McCabe. Janet has been a longtime colleague, both in her various roles at the US EPA, as well as her prior role with state government in Indiana, and has always been extraordinarily helpful in working through energy and air-related issues and thinking creatively about how we find solutions to meet various targets and goals. So I'm very pleased to introduce her today and have her join the call and appreciate her time and those of the other staff at EPA. Janet?
Thank you, Dave. That was very kind. And we certainly do appreciate the long and very positive partnership that EPA has with NASIO and with the state energy offices. And I think this rule in particular has brought us together in ways that we never thought we would be brought together. And I think the very, very positive effect for the people that we serve in this country. I just wanted to take a minute, and then I'm going to turn it over to Sarah Dunham, the director of our Office of Atmospheric Programs, to just take a very few minutes and run through some of the key features of the final rule that we just wanted to highlight, and then spend most of the time taking your questions. We've been spending a lot of time on the phone with people answering questions, and it's all a great learning opportunity for everybody. We realize that the 111D rule is large and complicated, and on top of that, we laid on you a 111B rule and a proposed federal plan all at the same time, and it's August, and a lot of people are trying to get away for vacation, and so we realize that you may not have had as much time with it as you either would wish or feel you need to spend with it. Please don't consider this to be your one and only chance to talk with us about it. I'm planning to be out in San Diego. I'm not sure who else from EPA will be there, but I bet there will be some people there. And we're always available to talk with you and answer your questions as you think about them, and there'll be plenty of opportunities of that going forward. So with that, I will turn it over to Sarah, and then we'll take your questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Jim. So I'm going to speak from a couple slides, which I understand were distributed, but I'm going to go relatively quickly and just hit some highlights. So if you don't have them in front of you, I'm sure we can get them to you afterwards as well. And we do want to leave as much time for Q&A as possible, so I will do this as quickly. The other thing, actually, before I start to do some of the basic points of the final rule, we distributed this morning, and that hopefully you all will have that as well, a fact sheet that is focused specifically on energy efficiency in the Clean Power Plan. So that, I think, we hope is helpful, particularly for those of you on the phone, to it calls out really how we speak to energy efficiency throughout various aspects of the both the final Clean Power Plan as well as the federal plan and the model. But really quickly, back on the basics of the Clean Power Plan, I think you all know very well that this was shaped by more than 2 years of unprecedented outreach and public engagement. You guys participated, and more than participated, were instrumental in providing critical feedback throughout this process, so we really do appreciate that, and hopefully you see how your views have shaped what we've done here. We've made a number of changes in the final Clean Power Plan that is directly responsive to the kinds of things that came in through the comment process as well as through the ongoing engagement that we had with stakeholders such as each of you. And we, I think, have all been really pleased by the extensive interaction and really substantive, thoughtful engagement that we've had from folks, and know that that's crucial to continue as we move into this next phase of the implementation as states actually develop their plans. And so, again, I don't view that our role of in terms of outreach and engagement is over now that the Clean Power Plan is out the door. We actually see that it's, you know, if anything, just beginning, certainly with respect to the next phase of this. So just quickly, let me walk through some of the significant changes that we made directly responsive to the comments that we got to the record. First, I think you all have seen that the year for the beginning of the mandatory reductions, that now starts in 2022 in the final package as opposed to 2020, which is where it was at proposal. I think you all know that we continued in the final rule to rely on a set of building blocks to inform what the reduction levels should be. And I think of probably great importance to this group. We had four building blocks, as you know, in the proposal. The final targets were based on just the first three building blocks so that we did not rely on energy efficiency specifically in the setting of the targets. That being said, energy efficiency is still a very critical component of how we see states complying with the Clean Power Plan. Due to low costs and large potential in every state, we really think that it will continue to be a significant component of the state plans moving forward. One of the other areas that we heard a lot of comments on through the comment process was both the timing and the level of reductions, particularly what folks started to refer to as a potential cliff that they saw going into with the starting numbers. And so we did a lot in terms of implementing through the final targets a more gradual glide path from the beginning of the mandatory reductions through 2030. The goal setting formulas, I think folks are familiar with, have changed again in response to the comments that we got. We are now applying the three building blocks to set two uniform CO2 emission rates, generally one for fossil steam units, really, and another one for natural gas units. And then, you know, there were a number of other things, as I attention before. Energy efficiency is not factored into the emission rates, and then nuclear as well as existing RE are not included in goal setting in the final. We made a number of changes for the state plan options and the deadlines for submitting the state plans. At proposal, we had a June 2016 state plan submittal date with the opportunity for 1 or 2 year extension. In the final, we're now asking for states to submit plans in September, initial plans in September of 2016, and then they can ask for a 2 year extension to September of 2018 for the final plans if they explain why that 2 year extension would be useful. State plan options. One of the things we heard quite significantly through the comment process, particularly from folks in the EE community, was concern about making programs like state EE programs federally enforceable, and that really was one of the main factors that drove into our providing for the state measures kind of approach, which is really directly responsive to concerns that were raised about federal enforceability. We also, I would say that the commenters had a number of really good suggestions with respect to trading mechanisms, and folks raised concerns about whether there would need to be upfront agreements across all state governments in order to allow trading, and some of the potential concerns with that. And so we are no longer requiring upfront agreements, and we have laid out what we refer to as the trading-ready option, both for mass-based plants as well as rate-based plants. So that's one of the areas that I think we fed off of some really good ideas that we got through the comments. Let me just hit on two more aspects in the final package. One is the Clean Energy Incentive Program, which I'm sure you guys are now looking at, which is essentially an optional state-federal matching incentive program for reductions that take place in 2020 and 2021, specifically for energy efficiency in low-income areas as well as wind and solar renewable energy. So I would expect there's further questions on that I'd be happy to address. And then the last thing I'll just mention that was a feature in the final Clean Power Plan is that plants have to consider reliability. States can amend plans in the event of reliability challenges, and we also included a safety valve to address short-term reliability concerns. So I will leave it at that, and I think maybe we'll just go to the Q's and A's at this point. There was an additional slide here that kind of lays out a bunch of different pathways for states. I think, maybe we'll get into that with the Q's and A's. I think one of the things just to highlight is that, there are a number of different compliance pathways. Ultimately, it is up to states to choose how they will meet the requirements of the rule. But I think from our perspective and specifically, just to focus on how we've talked about energy efficiency, we really believe demand-side energy efficiency is an important proven strategy and is an important strategy regardless of the plan type that states choose. It will be treated slightly differently, and there are different requirements for the state plans with respect to energy efficiency depending on the type of plan that's chosen. But regardless, we really do believe that energy efficiency is going to be an important piece, whether a mass-based or a rate-based or a state measures or an emission standard kind of path is chosen. So I will stop there and maybe turn it back to you, Dave, to start the Q&A portion.
Yeah, and Dave, we have a whole group of people here from EPA to answer various types of questions, so we may farm them around to different people.
Okay, great. Actually, this is Rodney Sobin. David is here, but I'll sort of moderate the Q&A session. And I am glad, actually, you answered the first question on the list having to do with the removal of Building Block 4 and whether that has any pertinence to how a state develops their compliance strategies. So a question had arisen as to whether the omission of Building Block 4 in any way limits the use of energy efficiency as a compliance approach. And I think the answer is unambiguously It does not limit the use of energy efficiency, and energy efficiency, any of the building blocks could be used or omitted so long as the targets are met. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And I also want to take a moment to thank those of our members who did submit questions, some of which we had passed along to you in advance. So let's move on to the next question. The question is, are these 111D compliance plans the same as what are called state implementation plans under more conventional for criteria pollutants? And does the guidance governing these SIPs apply to these apply to the compliance plans under the Clean Power Plan? So the question is, there's various procedures, there's various guidance that have traditionally applied to SIPs. Do they apply in this circumstance or not?
Hi, all. This is Angie Shadows from OAQPS. So the SIPs, the traditional SIPs and the CPP compliance plans are going to be different animals. The state CPP compliance plans, so they're not the same as a traditional Section 110 state implementation plan. The traditional SIP plans generally focused on a particular non-attainment area and bringing that area into attainment for a particular criteria pollutant standard, as you all know. While the Clean Power CPP plans are focused on how sources in a state will make their choices to reduce the CO2 emissions to comply with the state goal. So under the final CPP rule, the states can set up that architecture or the framework, and the sources or the EGUs can make their compliance choice decisions within that framework. So SIP guidance was written with Section 110 in mind. We didn't write it specifically to address other rules or other or compliance with other sections of the Act. We do recognize that we have learned lessons in the SIP submittal process, and to that end, we do expect to apply those lessons learned. So especially the importance of ensuring national consistency and timely review of state submittals. I want to point out that in the past, a few states have used energy efficiency and renewable energy in 110 SIPs, namely in the 1997 Ozone NAC submittals. And as states work to comply with the Clean Power Plan, we expect that the energy efficiency and the renewable energy choices that states and the EGUs choose to make will also be available for those states for use in upcoming 110 SIPs. So we recognize that actions that reduce CO2 emissions at EGUs also have co-benefits of reducing NOx, SOx, and particulate matter. And we encourage states to use existing EPA guidance, such as the roadmap for incorporating EERE into SIPs, in order to incorporate those energy efficiency and renewable energy policies and programs, whether they're voluntary or not, into upcoming 110 SIPs. I want to point out that roadmap guidance did also address other things that are of interest to states as they work to craft a CPP submittal, and that's energy system overview, information on emission measurement and verification, EM&V, and also methods for quantifying EERE emission reductions. And those are always helpful to review and work from as a starting point.
Okay, thank you very much. That's very helpful. The next question, actually, Sarah went over a portion of it in mentioning that last slide, but we didn't go in too much detail. But maybe if you can give sort of the thumbnail sketch of what the different state plan pathways are, and if you could also distinguish what's meant by the state measures path as compared to the MAS goal path. When might a state want to choose one over the other?
Thanks, Rodney. This is Jeremy Tarr and OEQPS. So I'll just provide a quick sketch of the various plan pathway options, and then maybe we could have others on the call from EPA may want to add, and this might be a topic that where folks have follow-up questions, we can go into more detail on aspects of interest to the group. So first I'll sketch out kind of state plan options where no interstate trading would be involved, and then mention a couple where interstate trading would be involved. So a state plan has the sort of forks into two directions. One is the emission standards type plan, and the second is a state measures type plan. So under emission standards type plan is characterized by having emission standards on affected EGUs, which means there are federally enforceable kind of defined obligations on affected EGUs. And these EGUs, once complied with, would meet either of three things: CO2 emission performance rates, the subcategorized rates, the state rate-based goal, or the state's mass-based goal. So, for example, if this was a mass-based emission standards used to achieve a mass-based goal, typically the state would put a tonnage limit on each individual EGU, and it could allow intrastate trading or not. Under a rate-based approach, the state might put assign as the emission rate for the affected EGUs the subcategorized performance rate levels, or the state's rate-based goal, or even perhaps different rates to different units, such that when they're complied with, the state's rate-based goal would be achieved. Under a state measures plan is distinguished from emission standards plan because it could include state measures either in whole or in part. So these would be measures maybe that are reflect state policies or programs. And under the state measures plan, it could include emission standards on the affected EGUs, but wouldn't necessarily. This state measures plan must be used to achieve a mass-based goal. So unlike the emission standards plan, the state wouldn't use a state measures plan type to achieve the subcategorized rates, emission performance rates, or the rate-based state goal, rather than mass-based state goal. Also unique with state measures plan is that it would have a federally enforceable backstop, which would be triggered, and it could be triggered in a couple of different ways. The federally enforceable backstop could be emission standards on each affected EGU that would meet either the CO2 emission performance rates, the rate-based state goal, or the mass-based state goal. And it would be triggered in a couple of different scenarios: if a milestone that's included in the state plan isn't achieved, or if the performance of the EGUs during step one or step two of the interim period is deficient by 10% or more from the projected performance included in the approved state plan, or three, if the performance of the affected EGUs does not achieve the emission guidelines for the interim or final goal. Another thing to keep in mind is that if a state chooses a mass-based plan, whether emission standards or state measures, it would need to address leakage, which we can talk more about if there's interest. Just to pivot to multi-state cooperation, which, as Sarah mentioned, was a big point of conversation over the past year and even before the proposal, there are a couple ways that states can set up the framework of their state plan to allow EGUs the option of engaging in trading if they'd like. One is through a multi-state plan where you'd have a group of determined specified states, named states, that work together and develop a common plan to achieve, say, a joint, you know, mass-based or rate-based target. There's also an option, and this is the part that's a little new with the final rule relative to the proposal, where we heard from a lot of states that they were interested potentially in allowing interstate trading, but is there a way that they could allow their EG to do that without the state having to negotiate an MOU or having to establish kind of a formal trading program that's negotiated with the state? And so the answer is yes. And this one of the varieties, it's called a trading ready approach, where a state could develop its own individual state plan to meet either the emission performance rates or the mass-based state goal, not the rate-based state goal, the emission performance rates or the mass-based state goal, and set it up in a way that it would have common elements with other states, which would enable EGUs, again, to trade either allowances on it in a mass-based context or emission rate credits in a rate-based context with other unnamed states. And by the way, the proposal, the federal plan proposal and the proposed model rule, the proposal is to have these type of plan approaches interactive with trading-ready state plans. And there's also another variety where a state could keep its individual, do an individual state plan to meet a mass-based goal or the emission performance rate and allow trading among named partners as opposed to unnamed, you know, unspecified, but states under the trading-ready approach. So I'll stop there. I covered a lot and see if there's any follow-up questions or if others on the line want to add anything to my answer.
Thank you, Jeremy. I suspect there'll be a fair number of follow-up questions later as people have time to try to digest this and the very useful graphic that you provided with the slides. I'm glad you started getting into trading because there are a couple of related questions that arose that relate to states or tribes, jurisdictions that do not have affected EGUs and therefore are not part of, are not governed under the, you know, plan requirements and do not need to submit such plans. So the question is, do states which do not have affected EGUs, can they still generate emission rate credits or emission allowances through their energy efficiency and renewable energy projects, or, and if so, do they need to be explicitly recognized in another state or in another multi-state plan to be included? And let me add sort of the related question of, can states without affected EGUs participate in the Clean Energy Incentive Program, given that their renewable projects and efficiency projects help avoid emissions from out-of-state EGUs?
This is Elise Steiner, and I'll take the first part of that question. The first one being, can the resources in states and on tribal lands that do not have affected EGUs be issued ERCs? And the answer is both yes and no, and I'll clarify. The answer is that yes, they can be issued ERCs for RE generation, but no for EE projects, with the exception that if the Indian area of Indian country is located within the borders of a rate-based state, then it may be issued EE ERCs. And then to the second part of that question, and more about the RE ERCs, do they need to be explicitly recognized in another state's plan? The answer is no, they don't need to be, but there are certain other criteria that would apply in these cases, namely that there's a contract in place or most likely a power purchase agreement for that resource to deliver the power to meet demand in the rate-based state. And then, of course, all of the other criteria that apply to any other RE ERCs, such as the installation date, after 2012. And there's a section on this in the preamble on geographic eligibility in section 8.k.1. Are there any follow-up questions on that part?
I think maybe we can go on to the Clean Energy Incentive Program, the related question about whether states without affected EGUs can participate in that program.
Hi, this is Beth Conlin, and I can handle that question. The state itself cannot participate in the CEIP program. Participation in the program is contingent on the submission of a final 111D state plan. But the resources located in those states that are eligible under the CEIP may be able to participate under another state's CEIP program if that other state with affected sources benefits from those resources. The question may be dealt with more specifically in a subsequent action on CEIP that will address design and implementation details. We also welcome stakeholders to comment on the rate-based and mass-based implementations of CEIP that are outlined in the federal plan and model rule proposal.
Okay, thank you. I guess I do want to go back to Elise's answer. If I heard correctly, ERCs could be issued for renewable energy resources, but not for energy efficiency. And I wonder if that applies under the Clean Energy Incentive Program. So say the District of Columbia or Vermont had energy efficiency programs, and those were included in an adjacent state's CEIP and plans, would they not count?
I think that we would want to confirm those specifics. Currently, the language in the final guidelines says that resources that benefit a state with affected sources are eligible under the CEIP, but I think folks will want to look forward to more specifics on those issues.
Okay, thank you. Next question which arose is, and we had heard in the earlier portion that a state that adopts a mass basis need not provide in its compliance plan details about energy efficiency programs and EM&V, that is evaluation, measurement, and verification. So the question, there are two related questions. One is, do those states need to provide any detail in their plan? Is it that they can be totally silent on those energy efficiency and EM&V policies and programs at the state level? Or do they include that in the plan as what we might call complementary elements? However, those elements do not require EPA approval.
This is Chris Sherry. I'll address that question. And I, you know, it depends based on the basic plan type. So I'll sort of walk you through the emission standards plan type and then talk a little bit about state measures because they do differ in terms of the need for EM&V for EE. With regard to an emission standards plan, so if you're applying federally enforceable mass-based emission standards on your affected EGUs, like through an emission budget trading program, EE, to the extent that you, utilize that resource and implement state requirements and programs to accelerate the deployment of efficiency technologies, all of that happens completely outside of the federally enforceable state plan. So it doesn't need to be referenced in the plan. It's really a complementary strategy that the state can take, and it can help facilitate meeting that overall mass limit at lower cost, but it's really not part of the plan. It may be a key strategy that the state takes as part of its overall process to meet the emission guidelines, but it's outside of the plan that you submit to us and outside of what's codified as federally enforceable. There are a couple of caveats to that, depending on some choices that states might decide to make. So for example, if the state is opting into the Clean Energy Investment Program, there would need to be EM&V of any end-use energy efficiency that's going to be issued early action ERCs by the state, and then that it would also receive the EPA match in terms of early action ERCs. So that's one limited context where for EE participating in that program, there would need to be EM&V requirements put into place by the state in terms of, you know, administering those early action ERCs or in a mass context early action allowances for EE. Also, if you're implementing an EERE set aside as part of a mass budget trading program to address the potential for emission leakage to new sources, if you're including it in your plan in that context, then you would need to have EMV requirements for EE that applies for allowances from that set aside. So I guess I'll stop there, and I think I misspoke a little bit on the IRC side because we're talking in the mass context for the CEIP. So if you were issuing allowances for energy efficiency savings that occur in 2020 and 2021, there would need to be EMV provisions related to those EE savings. So I'll stop there for a second and see if there's any clarifying questions.
Thank you. Actually, the next question is quite related. The rule does mention that mass-based states can have set-aside allowances, and I think many of us are not so familiar with that, so could you say something about what is meant by set-aside allowances? And also a point that you had made that a state that uses these set-aside allowances are subject to the EMV requirements equivalent to if they were using the rate basis, unlike non-set-aside allowances. And so the subsidiary question is why?
Well, can I jump in just to clarify, then I'll hand it over to Denise to talk a little bit more in general about set-asides.
Sure.
But those EMV provisions would only apply in limited circumstances where you're using a set-aside for EE and RE to meet a state plan requirement to address potential emission leakage to new sources. So if you're not doing that, right, if it's not done to meet that plan requirement, states would have full discretion in terms of how they allocate allowances and any kind of provisions that they might include in terms of the methods for that. So that wouldn't necessarily require EMV if you wanted to administer an EERE set aside, but it's not being done to meet that leakage requirement.
Okay, thank you. That was not clear in my reading of the rules, so we may have subsequent questions afterwards.
Okay, and hi, Rodney. This is Denise Mulholland, and I can follow up with a response here on sort of to talk more broadly about set-asides. So under MASP programs, certainly under all programs, states have a lot of flexibility to incentivize specific investments, such as energy efficiency and renewable energy. And one way is through this set-aside that somebody asked about. So basically, under a mass-based program, the state can just choose to set aside a certain number of allowances from the total pool of emission allowances that they have, and they can do this to reward specific investments that they want to promote or advance. So essentially, the state would set up eligibility criteria as to who can get these allowances, and then the EERE, you know, project providers that do get the allowances can then sell them, they can trade them, they can, you know, generate revenue with these to support their projects for energy efficiency and renewable energy. So one thing to point out is basically with this, with the set-aside option, you know, there's no increase to the overall cap. You're just taking them from your larger pool. And states have a lot of flexibility. They can create a small set-aside, which I think historically people have thought about set-aside programs as very small. But that doesn't have to be the case. So states can determine how big or how small they want to actually set aside in terms of allowances, or they can just directly allocate allowances, as many as they want, for energy efficiency and renewable energy investments. They could even auction the allowances and use the revenue for energy efficiency and renewable energy investments.
So it sounds like a state has in its discretion if it wants to do a carve-out for particular types of projects or particular energy sources. So if my state has X number of allowances, I can decide that Y percent can go for, can be applied to building upgrades or something of that nature, it sounds like.
Yes. The states have a lot of flexibility to decide how much to, you know, set aside to allocate to auction, and they can decide how to use that revenue or what to do that's in their interest.
And these set-asides are distinguished from what we heard before about set-asides, which are developed for the purpose of addressing potential leakage.
Yes, they are.
That's okay. Correct. So there are other ways that you could meet that leakage requirement for a state plan. So, for example, by under state law regulating new sources. And in that context, there would be no need for any EERE set-aside to meet that leakage requirement. So you would have the full allowance budget to allocate at your discretion.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful.
Ronnie, let me just add one thing that I think Denise mentioned, but just to highlight the other opportunity that mass-based programs offer is not only through the direct allocations and possible set-asides there, but also the ability to either auction some portion or all of those allowances and to use those auction proceeds to essentially, you know, incentivize or encourage investments in certain projects. And I think, you know, probably there's a number of folks on the phone who are very familiar with, for example, many of the states in the Northeast have done exactly that through the RGGI program.
Okay. Thank you very much. A couple of questions arrived having to do with EM&V, evaluation, measurement, and verification. And this gets a little bit in the weeds. The rule says that EM&V used in rate-based programs must be what's called ex post. That means they're quantified the generation or the energy savings after the fact. So the question arises a little bit about mechanics, because many energy efficiency programs, particularly in the utility sector, are evaluated sometime after the measures are implemented. So the question came up, how can a program or project saving energy in, say, 2022 generate ERCs in 2022 if ex post evaluation doesn't occur until 2023 or after? So that's a question, and let me, while I'm on the EM&V subject, there's also a question that arose, can what so-called deemed savings that are often used in utility programs, like, you know, utility rebates for Energy Star equipment and such, can deemed savings be used for EM&V for clean power plant purposes? And I put as parenthetically my note, it's a little bit like the energy efficiency version of these AP42 emissions factors that you guys are familiar with.
Right. So this is Chris Sherry again. I'll take the first part and then hand it over to Denise for the second part. So an emission rate credit would be a compliance unit that's being used to meet a federally enforceable emission standard. And under the statute and also our implementing regulations generally for Section 111, those emission standards, they need to be quantifiable, they need to be verifiable, they need to be enforceable, et cetera. So in the context of using end-use efficiency as a measure to adjust a reported CO2 emission rate for an affected EGU, that, you know, by default basically mandates ex post quantification of those savings just to fit into that general framework. So in the example that you gave, ERCs would be issued for megawatt hour generation or savings that occur during 2022, but the ERCs would be issued subsequent to 2022 once the megawatt hours have been quantified and verified through an M&V report submitted to the state, and then that the state has gone through the process of reviewing and approving that M&V report and then issuing the ERCs. So they could be issued, obviously, ERCs for savings that occur in calendar year 2022, but would need to go through that quantification and verification process and issuance process by the state to essentially provide the, you know, the compliance unit to the EE provider that could then be used by affected EGUs to comply with their emission standards.
Thank you.
Okay. And on the deemed savings question, Rodney. Yes, you know, in the draft guidance that we just issued, deemed savings can be acceptable in certain circumstances. So basically for the EE components that contribute relatively little savings, or where there's little uncertainty as to the average unit savings that they're going to achieve, the draft guidance includes specific information, section 2.4 in particular, on the terms, suggested approaches, and the technical assumptions that we call for that strive to ensure that the appropriate safeguards for the use of deemed savings are implemented. You know, as you know, of course, we're taking comment on the draft, and as we work to finalize it, we're really interested in feedback on specific areas, and one of the areas, you know, is whether or not the guidance includes sufficient information about the appropriate circumstances and safeguards for using deemed savings in our EM&V.
Thank you. Another question that was provided is noting the proposal for the federal plan. And the proposal for the federal plan on the rate side includes some renewable energy categories, but not all, and it omits energy efficiency for eligibility for ERCs. And then there's sort of a parallel reading regarding allowances. However, you at EPA asked for comments on including efficiency and the other renewable categories. So I guess some have asked for a discussion on why efficiency and some of the renewables were omitted from the proposal.
Sure. This is Beth Conlon. The main reason why the eligible measures were defined in this manner in the proposed federal plan was to address the need for streamlined EMMB as part of specifically the implementation of federal plans by the EPA. You know, it may be possible that we'll need to implement this across multiple jurisdictions. And we'd also just like to acknowledge that the real experience in implementing EMMB is what is occurring at the state level. So under this proposed approach, we decided to assure that all the eligible technologies are able to have their generation quantified and verified using a revenue quality meter, which we know provides feasible, streamlined, timely EMMB that can be implemented at the federal level. But we do want to take comment on, we really want to hear about if we were to include demand-side EE and other types of RE, how we could do streamlined EMMB that could be implemented by EPA in this context.
Okay, thank you. Another question is, it seems like IRCs and in some circumstances allowances can be issued for end-use energy efficiency, and there's a definition for that, but it didn't seem clear where transmission and distribution efficiency gains could be recognized. So a quick read of the rule suggests efficiency at the power plant can count and end-use efficiency, but it's not clear where the in-between efficiency, T&D, occurs and how it's recognized. Could you address that, please?
Sure. This is Denise again. So basically, we do allow for transmission and distribution efficiency gains to be, you know, recognized through the rule, and in fact, we encourage it. There's a section of the preamble, section 8.K.1, that talks about the different measures that that can be used, certainly under a rate-based program, to adjust the CO2 performance rate. Specifically, we do say that T&D measures that improve the efficiency of the transmission distribution system and or reduce electricity use may be used to adjust the CO2 emissions rate. What we include here are those measures that reduce losses of electricity during delivery from a generator to an end user. This is sometimes referred to as line losses. And we also talk about transmission and distribution measures that reduce electricity use at the end users, such as conservation voltage reduction. So there are some eligibility requirements, like they must be installed after 2012, and we talk about those also in section 8.K.1, and the megawatt hours of avoided losses or reduction in the end use that results from these measures must, of course, be quantified in accordance with our M&B requirements that we describe in the preamble in the same section.
Okay, thank you. That's very useful. Very helpful. I think we can open the question up to folks on the phone, and I also want to take a moment to recognize my colleague Shamika Spencer, who has been the technical magic behind this, and thank her for her help, and ask Shamika to unmute the microphones to see if anyone on the phone has additional questions.
Is unmuted now, and they can ask their questions.
So, Rodney, this is Chris James with the Regulatory Assistance Project. I wanted to follow up on Angie Shattis's answer on the guidance, and maybe just to put a finer point on this so that we're clear. So the states are going to be in the process of looking at the quantity of CO2 that could be saved from, you know, energy efficiency renewable programs. I think the specific question is, can that same analysis also be applied to fine particle and ozone?
Before the answer comes, could I ask that those who are not actually asking questions mute their own personal phones?
Hey, Chris, this is Angie. I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to repeat the last part because you were stumped on.
Okay. Yeah, I know. It was kind of muddled. So, I appreciate the answer on the CO2, but what we're hearing from some of the states that we have talked with are, they're looking at the quantity of CO2 or avoided CO2 that can be achieved through existing and future energy efficiency programs, especially if they're being ramped up. And, that analysis is pretty detailed and prescribed as, per the guidance. But the specific question is, can that same savings, once you're doing CO2, it's not that difficult to also quantify NOx and SO2. Could that also be applied to existing fine particle and ozone problems programs, are there additional steps that would need to be done? I guess that's the issue, just trying to see how streamlined this can be.
Hey, Chris, this is Angie. So, we've talked about co-benefits before, and we view that as a co-benefit. You're reducing CO2, you're reducing other emissions. You're doing that demonstration for CO2. We view that demonstration as very, very much being in line with what we'd need for a next 110 SIP.
Okay, great. I think it's important for the folks on the phone just to be, abundantly clear that, this work that they're doing, which can be quite extensive, has multiple benefits, and it's not necessarily limited to CO2. So that's very helpful for everybody to hear. Thanks, Angie.
Thank you. Any other questions from the line?
This is Dave Jenkins from Wisconsin. I just had a question about what was the final decision on the treatment of biomass fuel with respect to it being carbon neutral or not?
This is Sarah. I will take that one. We recognized in the final package that biomass can be a very important strategy going forward in terms of preserving our sort of carbon stock in our forest resources in this country. And there's been a lot of work that's happened at the state level and other places to ensure that the incentives are going towards preserving if going carbon stock of this country. And so what we really wanted to do was recognize that. So particularly for states who want to use biomass as a greenhouse gas mitigation strategy as part of their state plan, they would be showing in their state plan exactly what feedstocks that they could be part of the plan and some kind of a documentation of what the carbon impacts of the use of those feedstocks are. So, I will say we think there's a fair amount of scientific support for things, like waste feedstocks, waste industrial biomass feedstocks, we think have minimal, if not positive, carbon benefits that we think fairly readily states could add into their plans. And then there's a set of other biomass feedstocks that, as long as the state has provided some documentation that the biomass is being sourced sustainably and what that means that it's sourced sustainably and some tie to what the carbon impact is, we think that those are viable pathways for states to use. But there are some documentation that is going to be required as part of that if the state wants to rely on some biomass feedstock.
Other questions from the line?
This is Martin Hyman with the Missouri Division of Energy. Based on the discussion of set-aside allowances, I was wondering, is there a way to earn allowances for renewable energy or demand-side energy efficiency under a mass-based system outside of the set-aside process?
So, a set-aside has just typically been used as shorthand in the past for allocating a small portion of an emission budget to EE or RE or other types of technologies. But It doesn't have to be, you know, read in that narrow of a context. So you can set up an allocation approach, for example, where you're auctioning all the allowances and using the proceeds to fund your end-use energy efficiency programs. You can set up, you know, a different method where you're directly allocating to EE programs or individual projects, and you can determine, you know, what portion of that budget you want to allocate in that manner and how to do it. So set-aside is really just a shorthand for what's been done in the past under some criteria pollutant programs in particular, where, you know, you're talking about 5% or less of the budget being allocated to support EE or RE. But you have, you know, much more discretion to do things that differ from that in both, you know, scope and just, you know, the specific methods and the types of technologies that you want to incent.
Okay. Other questions?
This is Andrea Fennig from North Dakota. I'm confused about who gets the credit when renewable energy is produced in a state. If it's exported out, who gets credit for it?
There's significant flexibility. We don't define that within the final rule. Basically, if the, say, renewable energy meets the eligibility guidelines of a rate-based state, those RE megawatt hours can come from anywhere with certain conditions. And those conditions specifically primarily apply to mass-based states, whereas what we are allowing to be counted for mass-based states is RE in particular, an RE that can be shown to be delivered to the grid for the purpose of supplying a mass-based state. Otherwise, there is significant flexibility, and RE providers and affected sources can provide megawatt hours for the purpose of our issuance to different rate-based states. And we tried to provide that flexibility, particularly because part of how we determined the emission performance standards was based on a regional quantification of RE. So we have that flexibility. Once an ERC is issued, trading is subject to the rules of ERC trading of the various states.
But also just at a higher level, the renewable energy generator, the provider, would be going to a state and basically applying for the issuance of ERC. And that state that they chose to go to would not necessarily have to be the state in which they're located. You know, obviously subject to, you know, certain limitations if they happen to be located in a state with a mass-based plan. But just generally, it sort of functions similar to what you've seen with the development of the REC markets, where you have renewable generators.
Could I ask people who are not speaking to mute their phones?
I guess it would be similar general framework to what you've seen in the development of REC markets, where you have renewable generators providing RECs or power to meet, you know, RPS requirements in different states, not necessarily just the one where they're located.
So it sounds like if I had a wind farm in North Dakota, I would have the option, if I'm the owner or operator of that wind facility, I could apply for ERCs or allowances, depending on what North Dakota decides to do, from North Dakota, or I can seek to offer that to another state to which my power has gone?
Yeah, assuming we're all talking about states in a rate-based context here, yes, so that you could choose which state you're going to apply to the extent that there's linkages amongst those rate-based trading programs. Once the ERC has been issued, right, it can be traded to affected EGUs and other market participants in other states as well. So there's a significant amount of flexibility to access RE from out of state, just as a general, you know, statement.
And then to clarify, under mass-based, say that North Dakota stayed with a rate base and I had those wind machines, and say that South Dakota had mass-based, I could offer those allowances. I could get those allowances from South Dakota if I had a power purchase agreement or some other contractual vehicle that shows those megawatt hours are being purchased in South Dakota?
Well, just to clarify, I mean, there's no trading between rate-based and mass-based programs. So if you're talking in the context of ERCs, I think we can address that, but I wasn't quite clear on the question.
Yeah, and to be clear, when we're talking about RE that is located in a mass-based state, the mass-based plan is never involved in this transaction. It's just that the RE provider happens to be located in a mass-based state. In order to be recognized, they would need to bring those megawatt hours to a rate-based state for which they would be issued ERCs. And to do that, they would have to show that that RE was brought to the grid in order to supply a rate-based state.
And just to be clear, though, I think the example actually was the opposite.
Which, yeah, yeah.
Renewable energy generator was in the rate-based state, but being imported into the mass-based state, and that we do not have. There is not a provision for translating ERCs into the mass-based system. The only, kind of exchange between rate and mass is where you have the renewable energy generation being built in a mass-based state, but with some kind of a power purchase agreement or something like that, where the electricity is being delivered to a rate-based state, that's where you can have the ERC generation associated with it.
Okay, thank you. I suspect there'll be more questions. Andrea, was that helpful? Okay, I'm not sure. Other questions?
This is Mark from Missouri. I had a quick question about could a state start off with like a mass-based plan and then revise its plan like 4 or 5 years down the road after its EERE programs kind of become a little more robust and switch to a rate-based approach through a plan revision?
I guess the answer to that, and we'd be happy to have further discussions, is we were silent on that type of a hypothetical. We do provide for a plan revision process in the final rule, so you can, direct your attention to that. We did not directly envision that type of scenario, but I wouldn't go so far as to say that it's necessarily precluded. So we'd be interested to, have further discussions if people think that type of scenario is likely and want to explore it further.
Okay, thank you. I see that we're actually beyond the hour, so I know that there are quite a few other questions. I would encourage our State Energy Office members to let me know if there are other questions or if they want clarification on some of the questions asked today. EPA has graciously offered that the conversation continue, and we will seek to have questions answered offline. Also, we will be sending, as a follow-up to this, to our State Energy Office members a list of EPA regional contacts. Each region has one or more staff members who are sort of points of contact on Clean Power Plan questions, and we will be sharing that with our members as well. So I do want to take a moment again to thank our EPA friends and colleagues for taking this time. This is a very, very complicated rule. It's a bit unconventional. I'm sure there will be questions continuing. But we thank you very much for taking the time and effort to help us understand this. We look forward to some of your folks joining us in San Diego for the NASIO annual meeting and the Clean Power Plan workshop. So thank you again, and thanks to participants in the call. And let's continue the discussions. Have a good day, everyone.
Thank you.